Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with the very versatile, very talented actor, Hilary Clements, who is appearing in three of the shows in repertory at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down survive, finding wisdoms otherwise. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about having the courage to ask the question, who am I? Or in other words, is the person I have been thinking of myself as actually all there is to me? Or, to put it another way, is it possible that there are parts of me, aspects of me, behaviors, abilities, instincts, inclinations, which I have, for some reason, always a good reason, pretended were not so, or to use the clinical term, been in denial for. As a therapist, and as you certainly know if you have listened to any of my shows, I believe that virtually all of us come out of childhood having had to deny, hide, pretend that something about us wasn't true. And it's not just, as you might think, things which are considered socially unacceptable. So, for example, temper tantrums, rage, anger. You might think that a parent would discourage the expression of anger. And in some cases, you would be right. Some parents whose parent discouraged their capacity to be angry are made quite uncomfortable, sometimes even frightened, by the anger of a small child, which can be pretty intense. And they set out immediately to distinguish that response, which is to say, to stop the kid from expressing anger. So you have a lot of people, and of course, I see a number of them in my practice, who are experiencing physical problems from having swallowed, stuffed, suppressed anger for 20, 30, 40 years. You really can't do that without paying a price for it. Anger is a naturally occurring phenomenon. We get angry. The problem with anger is not the expression of it. It is the suppression of it. And so if you have permission to recognize when you're angry, to say, I am angry, even to express your anger in not a self-destructive or other destructive way, then the anger, you know, bubbles up, comes out, dissipates into the universe. But if, as so many people have, you learned, which is to say your brain learned, that at the beginning of the sensation of anger, the brain drops a suppression chemical, don't feel that, in your bloodstream. And you can feel anything from numb, put shut down, giggling. There are all kinds of ways that the brain has of making sure that anger doesn't come out. It can't stop it from happening because, as I said, getting angry is not a pathology. We get angry. Sometimes we get angry for no good reason, but still, we get angry. So, you know, this is not rocket science. Pretty much everybody knows now that if you are unable to ever express some really powerful or intense emotion, it doesn't go away. It isn't as though it didn't happen. You pay a price for it. And, you know, some of the common prices are ulcers, migraine, headaches, headaches of sort of any kind, depression, apathy, sadness, despair, self-criticism, you know, not liking yourself very much. Lots of prices to pay for the suppression of anger. But it is not only things like anger, which sometimes have a bad connotation, which people suppress. And sometimes it can be the opposite. I know a woman who's was unable to express anger because her family discouraged it. But when her little boy started to rage, she thought, oh, good for him, and encouraged that, which is another problem, because this little boy didn't learn how to temper that emotion, and got the idea that just letting it express itself in the way that a toddler would express was okay. And perhaps you can see how that might have gotten him into trouble later in life. Also, people suppress things which are quite nice. I had a client once whose parent, because of a certain kind of religious upbringing, thought joy was the devil's tool and stomped on it whenever she saw it. And so my client was unable to experience her joy. So what am I saying here? I am saying that it is possible that something about you was discouraged in your family of origin, in your classroom, by some other relative, a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle who did or didn't live with you, your peer group. You know, your peer group might have had the idea that a tough persona was attractive and important. You know, this can happen mostly to boys, but more and more little girls are encouraged to do that as well. And so any sign of vulnerability, of sensitivity, of shyness, could be seen as weak and therefore unattractive, and again, suppressed. So, the Lynn Show is all about beginning to ask the question, am I all, I don't know if you're old enough to remember the army head, this is a saying, which I think is pretty funny, be all that you can be, when, of course, the army is not going to encourage your vulnerability, your sensitivity, or your shyness. Well, never mind. So, but the question still is a good one. Are you all that you can be? And if you suspect, wonder, are curious, or maybe even more than curious, actually know that there are things about yourself that you get hints of it, but you have not been able to demonstrate it, express it, let it out, even acknowledge it, take responsibility of it, be proud of it. Let me assure you that you cannot be anything that the rest of us are not. You cannot experience anything that human beings don't experience. There can be nothing wrong with you because you experience things which you think are unattractive, ugly, dangerous, maybe cause some kind of threat for you. Because, of course, if a parent has strongly enough discouraged something in you, then the implication is if you do this, I won't love you. And all children know if they are not loved, they are in danger of their lives. Even if no parent ever makes that threat, even if it isn't remotely possible, it is what we concerns us. As children, we only have really one agenda, and that is to make the parent, the giant on whom our life depends, like us, be happy. And we will do pretty much anything. Children whose parents really like dependent children will stifle their ability to be independent, their autonomy, and the other way around. Children who have parents who want little self-reliant beings may be unable to demonstrate when they need help, to not only ask for help, but even to believe that they need it. And you can see how either one of these extremes can get you in trouble later in life. So, the first thing I always ask is, are you wondering? Are you curious? Is it possible? And then if you think that it is, what is it? What is it about you that you aren't able to be, haven't been able to access? And if you want more information about this, I have talked about this in many of the shows, not all of them, but many. I have a book called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can get access to the shows, all of the shows, and the book, and me, by going up on my website, thelynshow.com, THELYNNE, don't leave the E out of Lynn, show.com, thelynshow.com. If you want to talk to me, ask me questions, think about coming into therapy, you can click on email me and send me an email and I will respond. The other thing I do on my show, besides talk about this, is interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because in our culture, since it is so difficult to do, the people that I interview have, at least in the aspect of their work, figured out how to be exactly who they are. And you hear it in every single interview. It's blatantly clear. If you've been listening, you know I've been interviewing primarily directors this year. But today I am interviewing an actor, and of course, without actors, what would directors do? The actor whose interview I'm playing today is Hilary Clemens, still a young woman, and you will hear us talk a lot about how young Hilary looks and how long she's looked it and how long she is likely to look it, but a tremendously accomplished actress who is currently starring in or part of the ensemble for three plays in repertory at the Oslo Repertory Theater. The first one was Once in a Lifetime, which unfortunately you cannot see because it has closed. The second is Yentl, which you should run right out and see because it is closing soon. And the third is Fallen Angels, which will play for a while. Hillary plays three amazingly different roles in these three plays, and you will hear her talk about some of that. Hillary is an example of someone who was lucky enough to discover her passion, and to not only discover her passion, but lucky enough to have parents that were willing to support that passion. So, although she was eager for it before, Hillary was able to start acting lessons at 7. And, you know, the rest is history. So, I will let Hillary tell you her story in a second. We did this interview in the mezzanine of the Oslo, which is usually silent, empty at the time of day that we did it. But, as luck would have it, a catering crew was setting up for something and coming up and down in the elevator and banging their carts towards the end of the interview. I was able to cut most of that out, but you will hear it. And I'm going to play a little bit of it before I start the interview, so you can have some idea what Hillary and I were contending with. And then after the banging, you can hear Hillary Clements. Okay, I am here, finally, with Hillary Clements in the mezzanine of the Oslo Repertory Theater. And Hillary is in virtually everything.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, no, it is true.
It's three out of the, I don't know.
Yeah, it's, well, but eight. It's three out of not that many on the main stage, right? What, three out of five?
I think,
six,
yeah, I guess,
maybe?
I guess so, five or six. Yeah. I have to do the math. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And remarkable in all of them. Oh, really remarkable. And they are so different.
They are, yes.
They are so different and require so much skill, really. Truly. So, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Awesome.
And that's clearly what you are doing.
I'm yes. trying anyway. Yeah.
Well, right at the moment
at
you
the moment
are.
I am.
Yes, you
yes.
definitely are. Right.
Yes.
Okay, good. So I only ask one question.
Ooh, all right.
And it is, how did it get started? Which is to say, how did you first know that I guess we could say that acting is the art.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right? How did you, what was the first hint, indication, inclination, what, that acting was going to be in your future?
You know, it's tough to say because it's been almost as long as I remember.
Well, the very first memory that you have.
You know, my brother and sister, I have an older brother and sister, and our mother was very interested in art being a part of our lives. And we read a lot and went to the theater and listened to classical music and talked about what it made us feel. And I remember my brother and sister and I used to take books that we loved and act them out and make plays.
Okay, but so
and then
how old would you have been?
Oh, I would have
then?
Been four. Three or
four, and there were books that you loved or books that they loved and they just included you?
Both, actually.
So there would be a book that you, the four-year-old Hillary...
was really into.
Really? Do you have any idea? Do you remember?
You know what? The one that I always remember was called Lamont the Lonely Monster.
Wow. How alliterative.
Isn't it? It's wonderful. It's about a monster who is really nice and just wants a friend.
Yeah, poor thing.
But everyone's scared of him.
Yes.
So, and I have...
And about how old are you when you remember Lamont?
I would say Lamont? I was about four.
Yeah.
Because I think that year I was a dragon or a dinosaur for Halloween, and I had a costume, and so I wore that, and I was Lamont,
yes.
the lonely monster, and my sister and brother were the other characters, and we performed it for my mom. And
you were Lamont, so you
I
were
was
the star?
Lamont, I was the title character.
You were the title character.
Of Lamont the Lonely. I think mostly just because I had a costume that fit me, but...
No, probably not. And did you want to be Lamont the star?
Oh, absolutely, I did. Yeah. And my sister, my older sister, she's about 7 years older than me, and she was in acting classes.
Ah.
And so when I turned, I think, 7 or 8, it took a while before I was allowed to.
But you knew that you wanted to.
I knew that I wanted to. Partly because I wanted to do anything that my older sister was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And partly because it was something that I loved to do. I was always playing make-believe games and acting.
Tell me about that a little bit. I mean, are you saying, I sat alone by myself and made up stories and acted them out by myself, or as in I had an imaginary friend, or as in I...
No, I didn't have an imaginary friend, but I would act things out by myself, and I would have very elaborate plays that I would put on with My Little Ponies or Barbies and things.
Yes.
Legos. And then also my brother and sister and my cousins. I was very close to my cousins growing up, and we would all play very elaborate.
So it was very much a part of the... of the style of this family.
Yeah, absolutely.
To be involved in, right? Yeah. So did either your brother or your sister go into this?
No. My sister has a degree in accounting, and my brother is a Marine. So
wow.
Yeah.
You could hardly be more diverse
exactly.
from this,
yeah.
right? So you're the only one.
I'm the only one.
So do you know why?
I don't. You know, I don't. It might have something to do with being the youngest.
Baby girl?
Wanting something else to do and wanting something that was mine. And I started acting classes, I think I was 7, I might have been 8. And then while I was in my first acting class, there was a local, I'm from a little town called Liberty, Missouri, which is about an hour outside of Kansas City. And there's a college, it's a college town, and it's called William Jewell College. And there was an ad in the local paper of an MFA, I think, directing student at that school who needed kids for a play. She was directing a children's musical called How to Eat Like a Child and Other Lessons in How Not to Be a Grown-Up. And the cast was entirely children. And so my cousin Aaron and I, my mom said, do you want to audition for this? You're in acting classes. Do you want to do this? It could be fun. It's right. It's here in town. I said, yeah. And we went. We auditioned and got in and did it. And I never looked back. I've done it ever
since. Not your cousin, just
you.
No,
although he did a couple other plays, but now he's a minister.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
He's up in front of the audience.
Yeah, and so it was just, I started out, being in acting classes and doing community theater in Liberty, and then by the time I was 11, and I started working at the Kansas City Rep, and a pretty excellent theater for young audiences in Kansas City called The Coterie. And I did a couple, in high school I did 2 seasons at the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival. Which
so you were a working actress by the time you were 11?
Yeah, yeah. And I was doing commercial stuff and
okay, so then
theater.
It's clear by the time you're 11 that this is not
really
just something,
a
this
hobby.
Isn't a hobby,
yeah.
right. That this yeah. is a serious business.
Yeah, I was missing school for things. And
really?
Yeah.
And so clearly you had the support of your family.
Yeah, completely. To a point. I think I have to really give my mom credit because while she really encouraged it and supported it, we lived an hour away from everything, because everything I was doing was mostly in Kansas City. So she would drive me and just sit in the car and do crossword puzzles while I was in rehearsals, because it was too big of a hassle to drive home and come back. And she would drive me to auditions, and there was a point in high school where I was in dance classes, ballet, jazz and tap classes, private voice lessons, acting class. I was a member of a young playwrights roundtable thing.
Goodness.
I think, yeah, and I horseback riding, and I was a very involved kid. And then in rehearsals or performances for whatever I was doing. But she was always incredibly supportive, but always made it very clear that if it stopped being fun, I just could stop. And it was never any kind of stage mother pushing.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of that growing up in the theater, from other kids and their parents, but. Just always incredibly supportive. But also not to the point where, I wanted to move to New York or move to L.A. and do it. And she's, nope, there's other people in this family. We're not doing that. No. And I really am glad now that she didn't, because I think I got...
You wanted the family to move. You needed to move, so that meant the family would need
right.
to move.
Well, luckily, my sister and brother are a lot older than me. So they were pretty much gone by the time I was really serious about what I was doing. But, it wasn't the kind of mother who was like, yeah, I'm going to uproot our whole life so that you can go be a
right.
child star,
right.
Cash cow. I mean, it was just not that thing. And I knew kids that did. And I'm so glad that she didn't and that we didn't, because I got to have a real life. Childhood and mm-hmm. life.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Okay, so still, it's not your regular childhood.
Well, no.
No, right,
I mean,
right,
no.
right.
I mean, I was working. I had a
right,
job.
You were working, yeah. right. So, high school, all these things, mm-hmm. all these different opportunities to be in theater, right?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. So then you graduate from high school and?
Yep. And then I came to Chicago. I went to Loyola University. It was important to me that I go to a university that wasn't a theater conservatory, where all I would be doing is acting, because I'd been doing it.
Yeah, right.
For
you were
so
a pro already.
That yeah, and I thought it would be really. I mean, in high school, my freshman and sophomore year of high school, I missed essentially the entire first half of the year. I would only go to school on Mondays on our equity day off because I was doing a show that had daytime performances. So I would get all my assignments on Mondays and then turn in the previous week's assignments and take any tests I needed to take, and then I would
good grief.
Be gone the rest of the week. Yeah, it was crazy. So it was really, I really wanted to just
be a student.
I wanted to be a student. And in fact, the whole first year I was at Loyola, I was a theater major and took all the classes, but I didn't audition for any of the plays, partly because I wanted to just be a student, partly because I thought, let's see. I think this was almost a subconscious experiment that later I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing. I kind of wanted to see if it was something that I really loved and wanted to do, or if it was something I was doing because it's what I'd always done.
Right.
You know?
Yes, I do.
And I
in a way, to
yeah.
see if you missed it.
Yeah, exactly. And mm-hmm. I did. Oh, I missed it. Oh, I missed it.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. So I auditioned for the very first play sophomore year and got in it and was in rehearsals by the end of the first week of school. And was like, oh, good. I'm back where I belong. Yeah.
Right.
And I've never looked back since.
Well, okay, so you got out of Loyola
yeah.
with a B.A. in theater.
A B.A. in theater.
Right, and?
And I then, within weeks of graduation, I did a program called The School at Steppenwolf, which is Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago has an intensive summer training course that they have and they offer. It's 10 weeks. They accept, in the year I was there, I think it's still this way, 24 mm-hmm. students, 12 boys, 12 girls, men, women. And you apply, and then certain people that apply are asked to audition, and then you audition, and then 24 are accepted. And you study with Steppenwolf Ensemble members as well as other people that they trust and have worked with and know. And you are there 5 days a week. I think we were there from like 8 a.m. to 5, maybe, I think. And it's just a very intensive program.
It's entirely acting or it's directing
it's
as well?
It's entirely acting. And it's dealing with ensemble acting because that's the main principle of Steppenwolf and Chicago as a whole. Ensemble acting is really stressed. So we studied Meisner, we studied the viewpoints technique, we did improv, a variety of different things, a little bit of Shakespeare and Folio. It was pretty amazing. And then from then I started booking work.
And you just started to audition?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where do you live? Where are you based?
I live in Chicago on the north side of the city in a neighborhood called Andersonville.
So there's a lot of theater coming out of
Chicago?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. For my money, I think it's the best theater city in the country.
Yeah.
In terms of quality and quantity. You can find pretty much any kind of theater that you might be interested in seeing in Chicago on any given
or being
weekend.
In.
Or being in. I mean, it's really incredible. It's there are new theater companies being formed practically every day
wow.
in Chicago, just groups of people that get together and say, let's put on a play, and they find some basement and they do it to places like the Goodman or Steppenwolf, mm-hmm. Chicago Shakespeare. So it's a pretty diverse city, and there's a lot of opportunity. And there's a lot of opportunity for non-union people. Now, I am a member of the union, have been since 2007. But it's also a great place for an actor who's just getting started and who's not in the union to do storefront work that really gets seen
mm-hmm.
and gets attention. And it's not, you're not doing theater in a vacuum. I mean, audiences are coming, and the Chicago Tribune is coming to review you, and the Jeff Award Committee is coming. You know, it's a pretty exciting place for theater.
For theater.
To do it and to see it, I think. I love it.
So how long have you been there?
I started school at Loyola in the fall of 2000, so I'm coming up on 12 years.
Right, yeah. 12 years, oh my God, right.
Which is insane. That's just crazy to me. I can't believe it's been that much time.
Why? Yeah.
I don't know, I think there's parts of me that still feel like I'm a teenager. You know what I mean? I'll be alone in my apartment and going like, how am I allowed to live alone in this place? But, you know, yeah, it's a feeling of like, wow, I've been in that town for 12 years. I mean, it feels very much like my home now. I know the city better than I know Kansas City now, you know.
That's an interesting thing to say, the feeling that you're still a teenager.
It's funny, and sometimes I don't feel that way at all. I mean, in some ways I've always been... I used to get teased as a kid for being, you know, 10 going on 40.
Yeah, right.
Which I think is part of just being a professional from a young age. You have a lot of responsibilities, and I think I always was a much more...
Well, you are apparently always a very focused person.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you
definitely
always,
focused.
I mean, from the minute that you decided what it was, you were a laser for it.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Yeah. And that's not a quality that's particularly... associated with young.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
So in that way, I've kind of always felt
older. Right.
But every now
maybe
and then,
you're going
I think maybe
backwards.
I'm the baby. Maybe I'm Benjamin Buttoning.
Oh, right. Exactly. Right.
Or Merlin, who's youthening.
Youthening.
I think that's a line from Camelot where he says he doesn't age, he youthens. I think that's what I don't know. But yeah, although as I'm getting, I'll be 30 in June, mm-hmm. and I'm definitely feeling much more like. It's so funny, but there's times when I'm like, I am an adult, you know. I am a grown up in all these demonstrable ways, which is pretty exciting.
And it's interesting. I mean, of course, you know, you don't look your age, so
yeah. I'm very excited that I'm currently able to play characters that are not teenagers. So
right,
I've broken
that you've broken
I've
the
broken
teenage
into the
barrier,
20s.
Right, into the 20s.
Very
right,
exciting.
Right, right, right. So, and this is not a terrible thing.
No,
right.
So, I'm owning it.
Yeah, good girl. but it is interesting, and I do think that, maybe I'm wrong about this, but acting itself, first of all, it's not a regular gig. You don't have a regular job. You don't have a regular paycheck. You don't have a regular schedule.
No, not yet.
So you're not living a regular life the way most people think of grown-up or adult or mature
exactly.
lives.
You don't have those signposts that say...
That say you're a grown-up.
Grown-up.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly. So it has to be internal.
Absolutely.
Because you can't use...
Yeah.
Right. Right. Also... You said you're living alone, so you're not married yet.
No, so, exactly. Right, so right. You don't have marriage or children.
Oh, exactly. Right. That's another one of those things that say grown up, right?
Exactly.
And also, and this is where I'm on a little shaky ground, acting, it seems to me, requires, if you're good at it, a childlike kind of openness.
I'd say that's true.
You know, to inhabit, I mean, you inhabit three very different women.
Absolutely.
Here. There's a certain, I mean, again, I'm not sure this is true, but an openness to allowing that to happen to you or let you become that, not to be rigid
sure.
in who you are.
Sure. Or at least to be able to, I heard it described once, and I think this is so brilliant, as that you have a box of crayons, and you, every time you play a role, you pick out which colors you need.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all you, but you're going, okay, I need this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this, and these colors can stay in the box.
Yeah, right.
Today.
But for today, for this.
You know.
Right. But that is not how most people think of a regular life.
No, that's true. That's true. It's funny. And being the youngest, too, in my family, whenever I go home, I have to work so hard to not...
Your baby girl.
Be the, you know, the teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't have children, I don't have a husband, I don't have those kind of obvious signs.
Right.
And I also don't go to an office every day. And,
right.
Although I'm, you know, I have health insurance, I have, you know, I pay all my own bills, you know, I'm doing it.
It's really interesting because those are, it seems to me, the things that that define a grown-up.
Yeah.
That you're self-supporting,
yeah.
You know, that you're... that you're responsible for yourself, not only financially, but in all the other ways,
right?
You know, you have a dentist, then you have, you know,
health insurance. Feed yourself, get yourself to where you need to be.
That's right. And you have an apartment, and however you take care of it, you take care of it, it's the way you want it to be.
I do have two cats.
And you have cats, and then you're responsible for something.
Yes.
Right, okay, good. So, but I wonder if this is not something that other actors also experience, the feeling of not being somehow legitimately grown.
I think a lot, I've talked to some people about it. Mm-hmm. I think it's different for everyone, but I know, and especially, I think it's especially hard when you're in your 20s. Mm. I think that it's a time when you're really starting to figure out who you are anyway, and what you want, and what your path is, and what your
and what
priorities are, and what defines you, exactly.
Right.
So I think, and you don't necessarily look like a grown. I mean, I get carded for...
I'm sure you do.
You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. So it's a little hard, I think, sometimes to be, not taken seriously, but to be thought of in that way. And especially by people who aren't in the arts, aren't in theater, and don't aren't able to see that. And you know, I know with my family too. I live in Chicago, and none of them do.
Right.
So they don't see my life on a day-to-day basis either.
Right.
So it's an interesting thing. I don't necessarily think it's a problem, but it's just an interesting thing to sort of.
No, that's right. I'm interested in this also because. I have this belief that that we get attached to ways of thinking about ourselves.
Sure.
And inevitably, the things that we get attached to that we think define us, they disappear.
Yeah.
And feeling and looking and being taken for young for as long as you have, and you will continue. I mean, you've certainly got 20 more years before you even look near your age, you know?
Staying out of the sun. Just
yes, right. right.
You'd be the palest person in Florida. That's
it isn't just that, you know.
No,
it isn't just that. That you get attached to that, and then it's somewhat difficult to surrender.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you know?
You know, I wondered, because like I said, I'd played teenagers for so long. I played a 16-year-old when I was 26, and mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Right.
It's these, and you have these moments where you go, ooh, am I, it's very exciting.
Yeah, very noisy here.
I remember thinking, having a moment where I stopped and went, is it going to bother me?
Yes.
When I'm not called in for these roles anymore. Mm-hmm. And I went, you know, maybe for a second, but I had a conversation in Chicago with another actress who is in a similar situation where she looks a lot younger than she mm-hmm. is, and she's very petite and tiny. And so she said that she had a conversation with her agent where she said, I don't want to play anybody under 18. I said, oh, I know exactly what you mean. It's because you reach a point where you are having to pretend on stage that you don't know things inherently that you know.
You have to lie.
And especially, you know, for me, it's truth on stage and authenticity is really important to me, even mm-hmm. in, you know, ridiculous farces like Once
right,
in a Lifetime. But,
right, but you
have
bring
to have
yourself
that kernel
to it.
Of
right,
truth.
Yeah.
And you reach a point where you're spending so much time on stage going, this character would not...
Know that,
understand this. They can't react in that way because it's. So I was finding that you start finding that you can't react
with any kind of spontaneity.
With any kind of spontaneity in a moment because you can't.
Right.
That you that wouldn't be the reaction of somebody who's 10 years younger than you.
Right.
I definitely think that is a huge benefit of starting to play people that are closer to my own age, because it gives you a freedom of being able to have that life experience and use the tools that you've gained.
I also looked very much younger than myself for most of my life. And I used to think that one day I would look in the mirror and I would look my age and it would be horrifying because I will have had, I didn't know at the time, you know, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years of not looking my age, right?
And then it would be there.
And then suddenly it would be there and I wouldn't know who that person was.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
But I suspect that for you, looking older will allow for roles that you can't play now.
That is the great thing about being an actor, is that you will start to have more and different opportunities because of your age.
Right.
And sure, there's parts that you can't play anymore, too, and that's sad.
You play them now.
You reach a point where you're like, well, I guess it can't be Juliet anymore. You
know? Right.
Unless it's a very experimental production. But you let them go, and you get excited about the new thing. I remember having the hardest time finding audition monologues when I was a teenager, especially, but even early 20s, because I still looked like a teenager, to find monologues that were about anything that was interesting.
Right.
It wasn't,
that had any depth.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah,
but it's so exciting now because I'm starting, Yentl is a teenager. So I still got it.
Yeah, right.
May is in her 20s, and Jane is, in my mind, in her 20s. We never say, but I think of Jane as being pretty much my age. 29, 30.
Well, at least.
Yeah.
No, right?
Yeah. And Kate and I are sort of, Kate is older than me, and we decided we're sort of meeting in the middle.
Middle, right. Right.
So it's...
Okay, well, we should say that is... Fallen Angels. And actually, you should say something about the shows that are still running.
Oh, sure. I would love to.
Right. So, is Yentl still running?
Yentl is still running through April 26th.
Okay, so why don't you say something about that and then say something about Fallen Angels so that we can have them come and see you.
Yes, please come and see them, especially Yentl, because it's going to be gone sooner, and is a really exciting show. I think it's so funny. So many people back in Chicago are doing Yentl? Who does Yentl? And I'm like, you don't understand. It's a completely different experience than the movie, and B, even from just reading the script from the 70s.
It
is what Gordon Greenberg has done, and Jill Sobule with the music, and Josh Rhodes, who's did choreography and movement. It is a really different night at the theater than I think people expect. And different than I expected. I had no idea what I was getting into with this. And it's really, I think, pretty exciting. And I think that all of the new music really revitalizes the script a lot, and really adds a whole dimension of energy and emotion to it that you wouldn't necessarily... I'm sure that we could have done a perfectly great straight version of Yentl too.
Right.
It's a pretty interesting script on its own, but I think the music really helps make it immediate and urgent and even more heartbreaking. And funny too. There's some musical moments that I think are just absolutely hilarious too. So,
was it difficult for you?
You know what? Yes and no. In some ways, having the music is incredibly supportive and great because you're having sort of your subtext.
Right. But I meant the character.
Oh, the character?
For you.
Yes and no. I've played women disguised as men before, and I've played a little boy before. So in that respect, it's tools I've used.
It's a crayon.
It's a crayon that's been worn down a little.
Mm-hmm.
But every situation is very different in terms of, every character is different, despite the outwardly, it's a girl pretending to be a boy, yes, but she's a very different...
Oh, yeah. She's very different than either one of the other characters
Absolutely.
You play.
Absolutely, very much so. And I think the unique challenges with Yentl have to do more with the fact that it's story theater, so there's a lot of exposition, there's a lot of direct address to the audience, a lot of, and then this happened, and then this happened, which as an actor I've always found can be really challenging to keep it immediate and keep it active when you're saying past tense, describing something that's already happened. You have to find a way to make it matter that you're saying it now.
Yeah.
Why am I saying it? Why am I saying it this way? And living in that moment while you tell that story. Narration is a really tricky thing to do. And there's a lot of it.
Yeah, but you do it great.
Oh, thanks. It's been hard work.
It's amazing. I'm sure it's been hard work. I'm absolutely sure.
And some crazy quick changes. And I almost never leave the stage. And when I do, it's...
Yes, that's right. You're there all the time.
Right.
You're there all
side.
The time.
Yeah, until
the
end, where I'm gone for about a scene and a half. I go change clothes and... Have a drink
take
of
a breath.
Yeah, have a drink of water.
Right.
Um, And then come back on for the end. So it takes a lot of endurance.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And physical as well.
Yeah,
as
physically.
Mental.
Right. Right.
I'm always exhausted at the end of it. And I always, it's funny. I remember saying that at the end of Once in a Lifetime, which the last thing we did was a tap dance.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes,
and you just leave feeling so up and happy. And at the end of Yentl, I feel very like thoughtful and vulnerable and tired
and alone.
And alone. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's always sort of like, okay.
Yeah. Right.
Yentl. And then from back in that one, now that we're doing Fallen Angels, which is just a ridiculous, hilarious.
It's just a hoot.
Meringue of a
play. Right, it is.
So by the end of that, you know, I'm always in a great mood because how can you not?
Oh, no, it's so wonderful. It's so wonderful. Noel Coward. I said a lot of this when I interviewed Peter. You know that this is a found play that it hasn't been done
in a long time.
Right. So by all means, come out and see.
Oh, definitely see Fallen Angel. It is Yentl. It's funny. I think a lot of people think of Yentl as being very serious, which it isn't. There are moments that are very emotionally affecting.
Well, the premise is serious.
The premise is serious, but we handle it in a way that's
not completely
surprisingly comic, I think. Mm-hmm. And Fallen Angels is just straight up
silly,
ridiculous.
Yes, it is.
British ridiculousness.
It's great.
It's so much
fun.
Fun. It's not. We're not doing King Lear. You know?
No.
Nobody's lies. Will
no,
be
and you guys are so fun. Clearly having such a good time.
I mean, great.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't really understand for a minute. Well, the first time I didn't understand when you're facing the audience and you're doing this stuff. I didn't understand
the mirror.
I didn't get it until later in the play when somebody actually talks about the mirror, I think. And so I understood.
Oh, yeah, come look at yourself in the
mirror.
Yeah.
So I didn't get it at the beginning, and I thought, what are they doing? What an interesting directorial choice.
We kept joking about how we should do the thing where you, like, blow on it and then draw something.
Yeah, so you should have done something. But then by the end, I figured it out, it was fun.
Yeah.
Okay, so I always ask, having given, really, your whole life, to this art.
Absolutely.
Is there anything you want to say about what it feels like, what it means for you?
Sure. I could say so many things. I really love what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, you know, today I thought that in this last year, I've been about 9 different people. You know, the last show I did before I came here, I played 3 roles, and it was Cloud 9. So I was 3 different people in that, and then I came here, and I'm 3 different people. And it's so, I'm always inspired, and I'm always doing something that I'm interested in, and I'm always learning new things because of what I'm doing, mm-hmm. Which is really exciting to me. And it's, you know, it's not an easy life, the life of an artist. You will be told so many times if you have any kind of training in the arts that you'll have about 9 different teachers or directors that will say to you, if you can do anything else, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is just a really difficult road. You are constantly trying to get a job.
Yeah, you're always off balance.
Always off balance. You never know. And I've been really lucky over the last few years that I haven't closed a show without knowing what the next one will be, but it's truly luck and skill.
No, it's not luck.
Having the opportunity in the first place, you know, having the it's being good at your job when the opportunity arises, but there's not always an opportunity.
No,
and you could go in, and the thing about our job too is that you can go in and be a great actor and do a wonderful audition, but you just aren't quite in the director's vision of what he wants in that role.
That's right. You're too short, you're too thin.
And you'll never know. That's the other thing as an actor. You will never know why you didn't get that role or why you did.
Right.
Especially with commercial stuff. Whenever I go in for a commercial and I think I'm terrible, that's when I book it. I'm like, I was terrible. I'm never going to get it. Oh, okay. Because you just happened to be what they wanted that day. And I think it's such a, and that's such a strange, that you have to be really good at letting go of things.
Of loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to be really good at that and trust in yourself and that you know what you're doing, or at least enough to keep going.
You know, it's interesting because I wonder if there's a challenge for someone who had success really early, which is to say that everything that you did when you were a child happened. You got all that stuff.
You peaked too soon.
I didn't mean that. I meant that you get used to thinking
success.
That you can have this.
Absolutely.
And so, and the world may or may not give it to you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true.
And so I think that that's an additional challenge. It looks like the best possible way to start, but it has its price.
It has its disadvantages, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's another reason why I'm glad that my mother didn't say, yep, let's go to L.A., let's get you on a show on Nickelodeon, let's do that, you know?
Right.
Because I think that's a problem that a lot of people that start young have.
Yeah.
For me, I think the lucky thing was that it instilled in me certain... It gave me discipline and an understanding of how the business works and how to behave in a rehearsal room and how to be a generous actor.
Yeah.
And I think having all of that from an early age and getting to watch older professional actors.
Yes.
In their natural habitat.
Yes, right.
Really has given me a pretty good, strong foundation. And really shown me, you know, I think, too, I didn't have any illusions about what it was going to be. You know, I got to see older actors that I knew in Kansas City that I was working with that were working actors, but weren't... famous,
stars, right?
You know,
right,
or, and still had to audition for everything, and
right.
Still had the day job, and
right.
And that it isn't glamorous in the way that I think a lot of, and sometimes it really is. Sometimes it's opening nights and champagne and pretty costumes and
right.
flowers, and it's very exciting and
yeah.
thrilling,
right.
which is why we, you know, one of the many reasons why we do it, because it's exciting. But a lot of the time, it's just a lot of hard work,
yeah,
and not. Getting
necessarily, right, getting what you want, right. And I don't know, maybe. You're a serious person.
I don't know if I would say that.
You wouldn't? What would you say?
I think I can be. I think I'm a thoughtful person.
I think you are.
Person.
Yeah, I think you are. I think it's a crayon in your
yeah,
box.
Yeah, it's a crayon in my box. And especially because, you know, we're having
a serious conversation.
A discourse.
Yeah, well, we are. But if you can do it, then you are.
Yeah. But I would also
I don't mean that you're not fun.
No. But I also I'll also say that here, this being here has been, because I've been playing three large roles and three shows all at the same time, it's meant that I've had pretty much no social life.
No.
Being here at all. And, you know, and there are some actors that I think, and maybe if I were still 22, but probably not even then. No, I know, not even then. But I know actors that can, you know, be in rehearsal all day for one show and then do a performance of another show and then go out for three beers at the bar mm-hmm. afterward. And I am not that actor. I need to go home and regroup and get my sleep because I know if I don't take care of myself, that I can't do my job. You know.
Well, so let me assure you that statement is the statement of an adult.
Thank you. And we've come full circle.
Yes, we have. We definitely have. And I think that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Me too. It was great.
So there you have the very grown-up Hillary Clements, who makes the point for me yet again. Here is a woman who knew before she was 7 that what she wanted was to be an actress. And she hasn't lost the connection to that part of herself, the part of herself who knows what she needs. If you heard the whole interview, you heard her say that when she went to college, she even tested it, right? So the first year, she didn't do any plays, just to see, did she miss it? And oh yes, she missed it. She knew that she missed it. She knew herself. And then when she got in a play, she said, oh God, yes, right, I'm home. I'm home. I'm where I belong. I'm who I'm supposed to be. Even up to and including the very last thing she says, which is, other actors seem to be able to do, plays, rehearsals, work till late, have a few beers, go home late, but not Hillary. Hillary knows what she needs. Hillary knows who she is. And so, although, as she also says, and so do does almost everybody I interview, that this is not an easy life. This is not an easy choice. You are always off balance. You can be rejected for a part which you badly want and are certain you can do for reasons that you will never know. It's insecure financially, even if you are, as Hillary says, as lucky, and of course it's only partly luck, as she has been, to be continually working as an actor, to know when a show is over what her next show is. That's quite extraordinary, of course. But she knows what all actors know, which is that that may or may not go on forever. So choosing acting, because it is who you are, what you must do, the place you feel at home, the place you feel correct, that is what this show is all about. Not the career that you choose. Because in when talking about, you know, how she knows how much sleep she needs, how much rest she needs, how much recuperating she needs. Again, this is not about her career. This is not about her as an actor. This is about her as a person. She knows that while other people may do other things, other people may even have opinions about what she does, she's true to herself. And as I said, you know, that is the statement of a grown-up, but not only of a grown-up, but of a person who has been fortunate enough to have been encouraged to discover and continue to honor herself. And I am hoping that when you listen to someone like Hillary, you are inspired to ask the questions that I spoke about at the beginning of the show. And if you didn't come in at the beginning of the show and you want to hear that, you can go to my website and listen to this show and any other show that I have done. So now let me thank Josh Hackney, who I thank every week, for his technical skills and his kindness and his generosity and his willingness to share what he knows over and over again. And so, of course, none of this would have been possible without Josh, and I continue to depend on him. And so if you need anything having to do with electronics or computers, or, you know, he made this computer for me, or recording, you want Josh Hackney. And you can get him, and you can get me, and you can get Hillary again, if you want to hear her again, or any of the shows that I have done, at my website, thelynshow.com. thelynshow. And now, as always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show. Something that inspired you, that tickled your curiosity about yourself, or just something that amused you, interested you, something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't